This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Right, joining us now is Professor Ernst Zinner. Thanks for joining us on the Jodcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Now, experience a rainy day. I haven't seen in a whole week since I'm in this country.
Well, it has been quite nice for the last few weeks, and the rain has just started, unfortunately, as you arrive. Now, you've spent much of your career working on meteorites.
Well, it started about 22 years ago when a group at the University of Chicago managed to isolate tiny dust grains in primitive meteorites, and it was done because these dust grains carry anomalous noble gases, but it turns out that these dust grains are actually little bits of stardust, which means they come from other stars. They're condensates from stellar atmospheres or supernova ejecta and made it all the way into the solar system and are preserved in primitive meteorites.
What type of meteorites? Is this any type of meteorite that people could perhaps find themselves?
Yeah. Well, there are actually different types of meteorites. These are called primitive meteorites because they're from small asteroids which did not experience a lot of geological activity. For example, on Earth, rocks are not very old because you have all this geological activity that modify and destroy rocks. Whereas on these small asteroids, these rocks were still preserved from the very early days of the solar system. And in these meteorites, we find these pre-solar grains, these specks of stardust.
Okay, and have you been involved in collecting the meteorite samples yourself, or do you get them from other people?
Well, most of the grains we start are from meteorites which were found somewhere else. And especially there's one fall in Australia of the Murchison meteorite. And the reason we work a lot on that is because there's a lot of material available, about 200 kilograms of meteorite.
Wow,
but
I have been collecting
meteorites myself in Antarctica. It turns out this is a great place to find meteorites because you're on top of 2 miles of ice and you drive around on a snowmobile and every rock you find is a meteorite.
So every rock?
Yeah, sure. You're so far away from any mountains, no natural rocks, very close any mountains, and so the meteorites fall on the ice and, you know, are preserved quite well because it's cold, nothing.
And there's no moisture.
Yeah, there's no liquid water. I mean, and it's a very dry place, well preserved, and it turns out by far most of the meteorites now have been found in Antarctica.
And I guess they're easier to find against the white of the ice.
Actually, it's not white, it's blue. I mean, you do it in areas where there's blue ice fields, where the snow is blown away by the wind.
And that's the more compact when it looks bluer, I think, more compacted ice.
It's compacted ice.
Once you've got hold of a meteorite, how do you go about analyzing that and getting
some information from it? Well, first you have to get the grains out. And there are two types, actually. They are so-called carbonaceous grains. That means they're carbon compounds and mostly silicon carbide, which is the same as carborundum, which is used for polishing and so on. But it does not exist on Earth naturally. And as graphite. And these grains turn out, once you find them or can extract them from the meteorites, all of them come from stars. They all have a stellar origin. And the reason is that you don't form these compounds in the solar system.
So they don't form during the entry into the Earth's atmosphere either?
No.
Oh, that's just the outer layer that...
Gets separated or gets heated as a meteorite. But the grains themselves do not form in the solar system because the solar system is oxygen-rich and you do not form these carbon-rich compounds. But we also can identify oxygen-rich grains which are from stars. But then it's much more difficult because you have many grains which do not come from stars but are made in the solar system. And in order to distinguish them, you have to measure the isotopic composition.
So an isotope, for our listeners who don't know, is when you have an atom with a different number of either protons and neutrons in the nucleus of the atom. So it's the same type of atom like carbon.
And carbon, for example, has the same number of protons. It has six protons that makes it carbon, okay? But it can have six or seven neutrons. So we have, and you count the total number of nucleons, so you even have 12 or you have 13. So you speak of carbon 12 and carbon 13. Now in solar systems, there's a certain ratio between these two. Okay, so you have a ratio of 8 and 9 between carbon 12 and carbon 13.
What's the reason for the different amounts of each?
Well, they're made in different nuclear synthetic processes. The carbon 12 is made by combining 3 helium nuclei. Okay, and this is called the triple alpha because alpha particles are helium nuclei. Triple alpha process make carbon 12. It means you make them where you burn helium because you have to have the helium. On the other hand, carbon 13 is made differently. You have to have the carbon 12 already, and then you add a proton, so you make it in stellar environments which are hydrogen, where you burn hydrogen. Okay, so depending in which environment you are, you make either 12 or 13, and then you get grains from different stars which reflect these different environments. So in the grains you have large variations in this isotopic ratio. As I said, in the solar system, it's a mix from many, many different sources, stellar sources. So this value of 8 and 9 is just some average. But in the grains, we can values which range from 2 to 10,000. So this is a tremendous range. But we can then tell from what kind of stellar environments these grains come from.
These are not stars now. These are stars before the
solar. Before the solar system forms. The solar system itself is 4.5 billion years old, and actually these grains come from dying stars, either from supernovae, which are massive stars that explode, or then intermediate mass stars, which are also at the end of their lifetime and lose a lot of material in stellar winds or in as planetary nebula. And the stereoform forms these grains. So they have to be formed before the solar system formed and then came into the solar system and survived and preserved in these meteorites.
Could you explain a little bit about how you actually extract these grains from the meteorites?
Okay, for the carbonaceous grains, you can separate them by chemical and physical separation. It turns out, for example, silicon graphite is very refractory, also chemically. It's not only a high temperature condensate, so it condenses at very high temperature, but it's also chemically very resistant. So what you can do is dissolve everything else in the meteorite. Dissolve all the silicates, dissolve everything else, and if you do it the right way, you are left over with silicon carbide. So then you have a collection of silicon carbide grains. You can even then separate them according to size and analyze them one by one. We have an instrument where we can do that, which is called an ion microprobe.
And the chemical processes you use, are you positive that it doesn't have any effect on the actual grain?
Well, it does not change the isotopic composition of the grain. It does not exchange, because otherwise you wouldn't have these tremendous isotopic variations in these grains. Okay. It might dissolve some coatings we have on the grain. It might be interesting to actually study these coatings, because they might also give you some evidence or some information on the history of these grains, what happened to them since they were born in these stellar outflows, until they came into the solar system. For example, they might have entered some dense molecular clouds and you might have gotten some layer condensed on the grains, and it would be nice if this was preserved to get some information, except this chemical treatment removes most of that, but it does not change the grains themselves.
Now, when you've analyzed different meteorites, is there any way to trace back where they came from, or do you just get a general idea of what the solar neighborhood was like before the sun existed?
Well, the meteorites, they come from different asteroids, and there are different types of meteorites. And as I said, these primitive meteorites are from small asteroids, and they also have there are differences between them, there are different classes, but essentially, most of the material which was around in the solar system, also the most of it actually condensed in the solar system itself, is still preserved in these meteorites. Okay, but a fraction of it is pre-solar, is from a stellar origin.
So are you able to paint us a picture of what the pre-solar neighborhood would look like?
Well, I think the grains, in principle, they contain some information, of course, about their history. So the idea is that these grains formed in these stellar sources. And actually we know that some of them come from so-called AGB stars, which are asymptotic giant branch stars, and some come from supernovae. So we know that from the isotopic composition, so we can infer this stellar source. But after they were formed in this, they probably had a long history in interstellar space. They come actually from different stars and made it at some point in the molecular cloud from which our solar system collapsed. Okay, and then some of them actually ended up in the meteorite. But they, as I said, if they contain some information about this history, they do contain it. They are bombarded by cosmic rays, for example. Hmm. So we recently actually could detect some sign of this cosmic ray irradiation, also in terms of a distinct isotopic pattern, because some of these cosmic rays induce also nuclear reactions and change the isotopic composition of these grains. So we get some information from that about their interstellar history. Now, the solar history is complicated because, you know, many of these grains probably were destroyed. So in different meteorites, we find different abundances of these grains, from which we can conclude that some of these meteorites had a more violent history and more of these grains were destroyed, which go into some type of meteorite, whereas some go into some other type of meteorite and are not destroyed.
Do you find that the composition of every meteorite is different, or are there quite
a few? No, there are different classes of meteorite, okay? So there's a primitive meteorite, as I said, they still contain most of the original composition of the material in the solar system. But they were also then exposed to different other processes. Some were heated, and they experienced what is called metamorphism by heating. So some of the minerals got changed and regrew, for example. Or some of them actually experienced water on the parent body of the meteorite. Okay, and
was then liquid water?
Liquid water, apparently. And that changed also some of the compositions. For example, silicates, which are exposed to water, change into different types of silicates. It's called, they are hydrated, and they form in different types, which are called phyllosilicates, which are hydrated silicates, so they have evidence of water. Now, this process does destroy some of the stellar silicate grains. Okay, so in certain meteorites, we have lower abundances of stellar grains, of stellar silicate grains, because of this hydrous alteration, whereas, for example, silicon carbide is much tougher and does not experience any destruction by these hydrous alterations.
I'm quite interested to hear there's liquid water on the surfaces of these asteroids. How does liquid water exist in the environment of the asteroid?
Well, there's a lot of water which came into the solar system. I mean, you know, hydrogen is, of course, the most abundant element in the universe, and, of course, most of it went to the sun and didn't stay around. But then oxygen is also fairly abundant, and it combines to water at the right temperature. It already combines it to ice, and then depending where the asteroids actually were positioned in the solar system, some of that water became liquid and had an influence on the surface of some of these asteroids.
It's amazing that you can detect liquid water all this long time ago at the formation of the solar system. That's incredible.
It's true. And some of these meteorites are very dry, so they didn't have much water. It was too cold, and it was not liquid water, and so they did have the chemical reactions to get hydrated.
Now, you spent 20 years investigating the properties of these meteorites and the grains on them. Are there any particular things that have really got you really excited during your time studying them?
Well, yeah, that's sure. As I said, these original separation steps were done at the University of Chicago, and we were very lucky that 22 years ago, when they came up with this first separation, we had the instrumentation to be able to measure the isotopic composition of individual grains in this so-called ion probe, ion microprobe instrument. So we actually collaborated right away, and the first discovery was the discovery of pre-solid silicon carbide. So we measured first the carbon isotopic composition and didn't know in what form it appeared. I mean, we got very large anomalies in carbon isotopes, mostly excesses of carbon-13 relative to the solar isotopic composition. And then we tried to determine what were the carriers. At that time, you know, the silicon carbide was not very purified yet because nobody knew that it was silicon carbide and you could actually get it in very pure form by destroying everything else. We mostly got the isotopic signature from it, but then by a series of other investigations, one was a Raman optical microscope, Raman spectroscopy, where you can identify minerals, and silicon carbide is identified this way, and then also in the transmission electron microscope, you could look at some of the small grains and identify them as silicon carbides by electron diffraction.
So that the fact that it was silicon carbide was a complete surprise, really, to everyone.
Well, you know, in hindsight, yes, it was expected, but beforehand you didn't know for sure, okay? Right. But that was really quite exciting because I was involved in that from the very beginning and it was sort of the first triumph.
And I guess since then you've gone on to, and the field has gone on to discover many more compounds within the meteorites.
And our laboratory in St. Louis has been involved in many of these actual discoveries. So another discovery was pre-solar graphite. And
that's just like we would get in a pencil?
Well, it's, yeah, sort of, yeah, graphite. This is actually small spherules. It's just a few micrometers in size. And again, you know, was a chemical and physical separation and mostly density separation which produced these graphites, and then you actually can analyze them one by one in the iron microprobe and measure the isotopic compositions. And another discovery was then the first oxide grains, pre-solar oxide grains. And these were not silicates, but were aluminum oxide, which is a mineral which is called corundum. But with the oxide grains, it's much more difficult. With the carbonaceous grains, silicon carbonate graphite, you destroy everything else, and when you end up with silicon carbide, and all the silicon carbide is isotopically anomalous, that means it comes from stars. Whereas with oxide grains, it's not the case, because most of the oxide grains are made in the solar system from this mix already, and it has a very uniform isotopic composition. So what you have to do in order to find the stellar grains, you have to measure the isotopic composition, and in this case it's the oxygen isotopic composition of many, many, many grains, okay? And if you're lucky, you then find a few which are anomalous, and then you can make more isotopic measurements in these grains. Yeah. But we have now the instrumentation, we actually got a new instrument, which, well, it's not quite new, we have it for 8 years already, which we could use to find pre-solar silicate grains, which are even have a lower abundance because most of the silicates are of solar origin. So we have to be able to measure thousands and thousands of grains for the isotopic composition.
So when you say you destroy everything else in the meteorite, does that mean you can only get one kind of grain out of each meteorite?
Yeah, it's destructive. It's a meteorite. But as I said, this Murchison meteorite, fortunately, we have 200 kilograms of it, and therefore we can destroy 100 grams at a time in order to make the separates and extracts. And the silicon carbide, for example, in Murchison has an abundance of about 10 parts per million. Okay, so 10 to the minus 5 of the mass of the meteorite is silicon carbide.
Is that quite a lot compared to other meteorites?
Yeah. You know, some other meteorites which are more metamorphosed and experienced more alterations and so on, say abundance is actually lower or they get wiped out already completely.
And I was just going to ask you, have you been involved in the Stardust project at all?
Yes, we got samples from Stardust. And, you know, the name Stardust was chosen because people thought they had met most of the comet consists of stardust, that means of stellar grains, which turned out not to be true, and it was actually so far fairly difficult to find any true stardust grains in the stardust samples.
Hmm.
And actually, I was not involved in that directly, but a colleague in our laboratory, actually, he found evidence for three oxygen-rich stardust grains in the returned stardust samples.
What advantage does the stardust mission give you over meteorites that you found on the Earth?
It doesn't.
Oh.
But in terms of, it depends what you want to study. I mean, in stardust, you know, as the samples come from a comet, so you can study the composition of the comet, and you know what was in the comet, whereas in a meteorite, it's different. But in a meteorite, you have much more material, of course, to play with. And also, it has not been damaged as much as the stardust material by the capture of it.
Right, because it's crashed into a sort of aerogel.
Yeah, an aerogel, and, you know, it comes at a fairly high speed, and then it gets mixed with molten aerogel material and so on, so it's much more difficult to extract the original material from that.
Right.
So it's much more labor-intensive. So it depends what you're after. I mean, you get information about it as a comet and some important information. For example, that it contains some minerals which come from the sort of inner part of the solar system, because the comet, it was believed to be from a Kuiper belt, so outside of our planets. Okay, and some people thought it had never seen any low, high temperature and so on, and some very high temperature phases have been found. So it must be that some material from the inner solar system was actually transported out there where these comets formed.
Right, that's...
And it was unexpected, yeah. You know. So it depends what we're looking for, you know. If we are really interested in stellar grains, meteorites are much more... a better source to get at them.
So what does the future hold for the study of pre-solar grains?
Well, you know, the question is where it all ends. I don't know yet. So far we were very successful in finding new types of grains. So for example, this is pre-solar silicates. We also discovered in our laboratory 4 or 5 years ago, okay, by having these new instruments which enables us to measure the isotopic composition of 10,000s of grains. Then you find the few anomalous ones. So, but the question, and, you know, before that, it turns out the total abundance of the silicate grains is fairly high. So except for the so-called nanodiamonds, and it's not quite sure whether all of them are of stellar origin, they have the highest abundance in meteorites. But a couple of years before, nobody knew about them. There was no positive evidence about them because it was so difficult to measure them because of the background of all the isotopic normal grains. Okay, so there was quite a step, and now they are sort of on top of the abundance list.
So what's a nanodiamond?
Nanodiamonds are diamonds which were actually sort of the first discovered pre-solar grains, because they carry a very anomalous type of xenon, which is called HL xenon, which has excesses in the heavy H and the light xenon isotopes. But these diamonds are extremely small. They are only 2 nanometers in size. So one diamond contains only about 2,000 atoms of carbon. And the xenon itself, which, you know, served as identification that these diamonds have some stellar signature, they also at a very low abundance. So it turns out only 1 nanodiamond in 1,000,000 contains a single xenon atom. Okay, so the question is, you know, are all these nanodiamonds from other stars or only a fraction that carries a xenon? And so it's still an unresolved question, and it's very difficult because they are so small.
Hmm.
Okay, so we have some ideas maybe how to determine the isotopic composition of individual nanodiamonds, but then you have to sort of be able to measure the isotopic composition of all 2,000 atoms, because, I mean, if you measure only a fraction of them, it's hopeless. Hmm. So we have some idea how we can do that, and I just talked with Ian Lyon a few days ago and hear some ideas how he can do it. So I hope eventually we find, because the strange thing is that in total, I mean, we cannot measure the isotopic composition of individual nanodiamonds so far. But if you measure the average by having billions of them analyzed, okay, the isotopic composition is very close to the isotopic composition of the solar system. Yeah. So if they come from other stars, this is not expected. So the question is, what is the true isotopic composition of carbon of these individual grains? So that's sort of the next challenge.
Well, we wish you the best of luck in finding out the answers to those questions. It sounds very exciting.
Sure, sure. So, you know, we can keep going for some time before we reach the end of what can be done.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay, it was a pleasure.